Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Attorney, Financial Advisor, and Concord State Advisory Board Member Alex Talcott. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News. We will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The partial government shutdown that began before the holidays has now entered its third week, as recent negotiation efforts produced no signs of compromise. If anything, the two sides appear to be digging their heels in even more. This shutdown is already the second longest since 1980. The partisan divide causing the shutdown concerns President Trump's push for $5 billion in additional funding for a wall along the border of Mexico, while Democrats oppose any new wall funding. The latest rumblings indicate that House Democrats may repackage less controversial funding bills, perhaps even sending them one by one to the Senate for approval, and addressing the Homeland Security bill, which would also concern border wall funding, by itself. This is certainly an ongoing developing story, as either side could make concessions or maneuvers that finally bring the shutdown to an end. The new Democratic chairman of the House Budget Committee would like to raise the corporate income tax rate that Republicans just lowered. The call is for the rate to be raised from the current 21% to 28%, which would still be lower than the original 35% rate that existed before the recent changes. The move comes as part of the fiscal year 2020 budget talks in the House as the government braces itself for annual trillion-dollar deficits. The chairman acknowledged that such a move would not likely be supported by the Senate. The House has also unveiled a new bill providing $12.14 billion in disaster relief. That would be a nearly $6 billion increase over that which the House offered as part of a stopgap funding measure last month that never became law. The increase is largely focused on concerns that Puerto Rico was not initially receiving enough to assist with rebuilding after recent devastating hurricanes. Up next, I'll be joined by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby to discuss changes in Congress and the partial government shutdown. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby. Bob is a regular contributor on Facing the Future. He's also a wealth of fiscal policy knowledge, and it's a privilege and honor to have him gracing our airwaves again today. Happy New Year, and welcome back, Bob.
Happy New Year, Chase. That's a bit over the top, but anyway.
Well, you know, we're starting a new year. I think over the top just needed to be the new standard for 2019. To step out on a good footing for Facing the Future, since fiscally the country isn't doing a great job in that respect. In fact, we've got a lot to talk about today. We've got a new Congress, rules changes in the House, a partial government shutdown, a lot to get caught up on since our last conversation before the holidays.
Well, let's go.
I wanted to talk about a very, very boring topic to kick off the new year, and that is rules within the House of Representatives. And there were some, I think, relatively significant changes with this recent rules package. So why don't we start with you describing or explaining what the rules are used for in the House and maybe some of the notable changes in this recent package.
Well, I don't know if we're going to be getting off to a great hot start for the year by discussing House rules, but
we're starting off with a bang and then a sputter.
Well, you know, each new Congress, the House leadership adopts what's called a rules package, which really just sets certain internal guidelines for operations. But in this case, the reason that we're talking about it is that there were some new rules with the change in leadership that do have a bearing on fiscal issues. So there was one that has to do with the debt ceiling, one that has to do with the pay-as-you-go budget rules and dynamic scoring. So let me go through a couple of these. Probably the most significant one is that the new House rules reinstate the old pay-as-you-go rule, PAYGO, which means that if you're going to enact a new entitlement program, what's called mandatory spending, you have to find a way to pay for it or cut other mandatory spending so it doesn't make the deficit worse. It also applies, and this is new, to tax cuts. The Republicans changed the rule when they were in charge so that tax cuts didn't need to be offset in any way, which is one reason we enacted a big tax cut last year that wasn't paid for. So the rules change does, I think it's a positive that the new leadership stuck with PAYGO. There are a lot of, there some of the newer members, some of the more progressive liberal members in the House majority think that PAYGO should be abandoned because they argue, well, the Republicans didn't honor it, so why should we? And there is a certain political logic to that. But I was happy to see two wrongs don't make a right. So I think
No kidding.
I was happy to see the leadership, Pelosi and Hoyer, stick with PAYGO. Now, that doesn't mean that they will actually stick with it when legislation is brought to the floor, because one thing you have to remember about House rules is that they are easily waived. They are waived with a majority vote. So basically, if the majority wants to do something, all they have to do is waive PAYGO, and they can do it. But it does send an important signal that the House would return to PAYGO. They also, and I think this is positive, made it easier to raise the debt limit. I don't like the idea of using the debt limit as, like we use government shutdowns as a way to hold things hostage, because if you start defaulting on government obligations, that's even worse than a shutdown. So they made a positive change there, and let me stop there. There are some other ones that I think were mildly positive.
Well, I wanted to ask one follow-up on PAYGO. You mentioned, well, I guess I have two follow-ups. One, you mentioned mandatory spending. So pay-as-you-go rules only apply to mandatory spending? They don't come into discretionary, like things involving the appropriations process at all?
Yeah, that's right, and that's a really key point. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about PAYGO. It doesn't apply to appropriations, and it doesn't apply to existing programs. So Medicare and Social Security and any current program is going to keep going up. It doesn't prevent that from happening. All it says is that if you're going to come up with an expansion, if you wanted, for example, to do Medicare for All or, expand Social Security benefits or expand Medicaid, you would have to find a way to pay for that or cut other spending, which I think that's certainly not austerity. It is just a logical thing to have to do that any of us would do in a business or in our personal finances, and it should be the same for the government to identify a source of revenue. What was so wrong about the tax cut from last year, other than its timing, is that there was no attempt to even honor PAYGO, and it's going to make it difficult, quite frankly, to apply it to anything.
And I don't want PAYGO to take up the whole segment here, but I do have one final question on it. Isn't there a difference between PAYGO as a House rule versus what I think is statutory PAYGO?
Yeah, this is another important point. We're just talking here about House rules, but there is a law. There's a pay-as-you-go law that you have to get around. There's also a separate Senate rule. And the House rule is actually the weakest of them because, as I said, it's easily waived, so it's more about sending signals. But there is a law that says that if it passed the House and the Senate, you would have to, there's a sequestration that goes into effect if something isn't paid for, and big cuts would have to be made. Now, why didn't that happen with the tax bill last year? Well, technically speaking, it should have, but Congress attached a waiver of PAYGO to a must pass a funding bill. And frankly, Democrats weren't any more anxious than Republicans to make automatic across-the-board cuts that would have paid for this tax. It would have required very, very big cuts, and nobody actually wanted to do them, so the waiver of PAYGO was enacted.
All right, so we don't lose our listeners here and bore them to death talking more about PAYGO. You mentioned the debt limit being raised as part of the budget resolutions and it being, I think, suspended when a budget resolution is passed. How does that function?
Well, what the House did was they reinstated something close to an old rule that they used to have, which means that when the House passes a budget resolution, it automatically generates a piece of legislation raising the debt limit. And what they did, that was the old rule. What they did was they reinstated a rule where they automatically generate a bill that suspends the debt limit for the rest of the fiscal year. So there wouldn't be a fight about the debt limit during the year. But that piece of legislation then goes to the Senate, and the Senate still has to pass it and the president sign it. So it only helps a debt limit increase get through the House. It doesn't, it still would face hurdles to be enacted.
And I think the rule you were mentioning, Bob, wasn't that called the Gephardt rule, reinstating that Gephardt rule?
It was, after okay. The former majority leader, Dick Gephardt.
All right, so dynamic scoring. I think the rule change simply took away the requirement for dynamic scoring as it pertains to budget projections. Can you talk a little bit more about that, again, how that functions and what?
Yeah, I mean, dynamic scoring is really, really in the weeds, but it basically the idea is that if you're going to take a major piece of legislation, you should try to make an estimate, the Congressional Budget Office should try to make an estimate of what impact it would have on the economy and how that would feed back into the budget score. It comes up most often with tax cut legislation, and the Republicans wanted to have this dynamic scoring rule where their tax cut would the official score would include its projected effect on the economy, and so it did during the last tax cut legislation. So I've always thought this a little bit speculative. To include economic feedback, I think you should do such an analysis. But to actually assign a specific score to it always struck me as a little bit too precise about these things. And so I always thought the dynamic score should be kind of a supplemental report, which is what CBO used to do. So essentially that's what the Democrats have now said, is that the dynamic score would not be part of the formal score. But you could certainly still do it, and it's important to take a look at what the potential economic effects of a piece of legislation would be. They only do it for big legislation. They don't do it for every little bill that comes along.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby. We are discussing the ever-exciting topic of House rules changes, and I think it'd be a good time to switch to perhaps something a little more exciting, and that is, well, exciting for good or bad reasons, the current partial government shutdown. So, Bob, everyone is trying to guess when it will end. I don't want to go down that path. I do want to talk about what some of the hang-ups are. And I know, you know, building a wall has been in the news, and that's the primary talking point. Is there anything else in the spending packages that's causing this to trip along the way, or does it really just come down to funding for a border wall?
That's it. It's the wall. There's nothing else. And in fact, there really, if you just look at Congress, there's not even a big controversy there. I mean, they had agreements on all spending bills and thought they had the president's agreement, and until he changed his mind at the last minute, and now the Republicans are saying, well, we have to, you know, go along with the president. So we actually had a very unusually smooth appropriations process, a pretty bipartisan process, particularly in the Senate. This is the reason this is so frustrating, is it's just like a last-minute whim on the part of the president, and now it's just dug in and it's become like this colossal battle for the ages. you know, just like out of nowhere.
And you mentioned that there was, before the border wall issue really became digging the heels in sort of moment for the president, you mentioned there was pretty good agreement across the board on the rest of the spending packages. Do you see any merit or even any likelihood that I've heard that there's talk of maybe just bringing in individual spending bills for the parts of the government that are currently shut down to get that out of the way and then deal with this debate over a border wall. Do you think that's even a possibility, or is the political climate just well beyond that?
Well, that would be a very logical thing to do, and I think there's certainly support for it, but I don't see it happening right now, simply because Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has said that he will not bring any bills to the floor that wouldn't get the president's approval. So, and the president feels that it's best to keep all of the departments shut down that are shut down because it increases the pain, ergo gives him more leverage to get what he ultimately wants. So if he allowed some parts of the government to open, the theory goes that would reduce the pressure for the Democrats to cave, and so he doesn't want to do it. But the upshot is that you have departments that have absolutely nothing to do with the border wall. They are collateral damage in this fight, and it really doesn't make any sense.
One other question I had about the shutdown itself is it's been talked about as a partial government shutdown. How much, like what percentage of the government is actually still humming along and funded as opposed to that which has furloughed thousands of people?
It's hundreds of thousands of people. And an interesting point is that 75% of the discretionary funding for the government was approved. Big departments like the Department of Defense and Health and Human Services, their bills were approved. So what you have here is a lot of federal agencies, but they're smaller federal agencies. So there's about 25% of the government agency budgets are unfunded. But it does cover a lot of people. I mean, agriculture is the Justice Department. The court system might have to shut down at some point. The Interior Department, which is why the national parks are in trouble. So there's, it is widespread. A lot of what people think of as government is those agencies don't have their money.
So last question here, Bob, before we go, and I want to sort of shift this to looking forward into this new Congress. You mentioned earlier it was relatively smooth sailing for the appropriations process this fiscal year before we hit this bump in the road. Does it give you much hope for the 2020 process, which Congress is supposed to be starting relatively soon anyway?
You're joking.
Yes, okay, it was tongue-in-cheek, but I do want your thoughts on it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like your football team loses 49-0. Does this give you hope for their playoff chances? I think that, I'm not just, like, worried about the Patriots here. I think that that next year's process is going to be even worse because this is going to bleed into it. And just think of how we get out of this one. Could have an effect on next year's budget because, like I said, a lot of the big-ticket items were passed. Suppose this drags on and on. Suppose the president decides he's going to invoke emergency authority somehow and reprogram defense spending for a wall. That might be a face-saving device of dubious legality for the moment, but it would surely bleed into the defense debate for next year. Because Congress would want to attach some sort of funding prohibition for that, and the Republicans would object, and so there would be no funding for the defense bill. You know, we could see an even more problematic system of appropriations next year.
Well, the only silver lining for me in all of this, because I think this shutdown is totally unnecessary. No matter what side of the aisle you're looking at it from, I feel like we could have gotten through the fiscal year 2019 appropriations process pretty easily. But the silver lining, I guess, I have in all of this is that we're in New Hampshire. We're in the 2020 cycle for the next presidential election. And it seems like fiscal policy is becoming a pretty popular point of discussion. And so I'm excited that at least voters will have a point of reference and maybe some ammunition to ask candidates some pretty tough questions on fiscal policy, and this might keep the topic sort of in the air in the interim?
Yeah, let's say it's a target-rich environment.
Very much so. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Bob Bixby discuss the incredibly exciting topic of the House rules changes as well as the partial government shutdown. Thank you for joining the show once again, Bob.
Thanks, Chase.
Up next, attorney, financial advisor, and Concord State Advisory Board member Alex Talcott will join us. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Alex Talcott and his son, Hank. Alex lives in Durham, home of the University of New Hampshire, where he teaches finance and business law and lives with his family of five. He also teaches at Great Bay Community College and manages the offices of both Seacoast Financial Planning and Seacoast Tax Services in Portsmouth. He's a graduate of Dartmouth, Notre Dame Law School, and he serves on many boards, including the Concord Coalition's own State Advisory Board. Welcome to Facing the Future, Alex, and welcome, Hank.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Hi.
So, Alex, I wanted to cover a variety of topics with you today, so I feel like we're going to do a little bit of freewheeling and maybe have some fun with Hank a little bit later in the show as well. Let's start with your involvement with the Concord Coalition. How did you initially hear about us? How did you come to be involved with our state advisory board?
Yeah, well, I first came to New Hampshire from New York for college, partly because it was such a civic place, and it's organizations exactly like the Concord Coalition that put on events and facilitate the kinds of conversations that I'm super interested in. And I remember attending an event at Great Bay Community College in Portsmouth before I was formally involved with the coalition. And I remember former U.S. Senator Judd Gregg of New Hampshire participating on the right. And on the left was former Philadelphia Mayor Ed Rendell, who was kind of a rock star to me. I always watched Hardball on MSNBC when I was a kid. I remember reading the book Hardball that predated the show. And for me, seeing Ed Rendell tanned in a pinstripe suit, talking bipartisan talk, like for free, with a couple hundred people in the room, there was a heck of a turnout. So I was kind of like, wow, this is not just a nominal organization. They are convening conversations, and I want to be a part of it.
Yeah, actually, that was a nice reminder. I haven't thought about that event in a while because I think it was, what, 3 or 4 years ago at least by now. But it was a great event. We had like 250 people at Great Bay Community College, had a fantastic conversation. And we always have good conversations at our events. It's a great state to do that, especially during the primary season. And you're particularly politically involved. Maybe shed some light on why you think fiscal policy matters are of particular importance to you and maybe even voters and what they should be thinking about going into this next cycle.
Yeah, you know, I've always been interested in the connections between federal budgetary matters and kind of what analogies there are or aren't to personal finance since I work in personal finance. And I think one of the most phony things that actually connects the two are when politicians talk about, oh, those couples working on their budget around the kitchen table at night. And that's just so folksy. And I got to tell you, like, it doesn't really happen. So not only is there not a actual appropriate budgetary process in Washington, it ain't happening around the kitchen tables either. So neither side is doing it. So I like to get real about fiscal reform in Washington. I like getting real about actually what is a constructive, actionable, you know, tip for families that I work with professionally as well.
I do get a kick out of the sort of folksy image of sitting at the dining room table, hashing out the budget, balancing your checkbook. I'm like, I don't even know if anyone in my generation understands what balancing a checkbook even is or what it looks like. Most of our financial conversations take place, you know, after we're binge watching an episode of some show on Netflix. And that's what fiscal policy conversations in the home look like.
And in some ways, there's no shame, right? Because our representatives in Washington, they're not drafting legislation by quill. You know, they're not burning the midnight oil.
I kind of want to make that happen again. Can we, like, force drafting legislation by quill? I think we'd probably be a little disappointed with it would, cursive.
Right. The legislation would probably be less voluminous, right? It would just the penmanship exercise would slow it down.
Right. Drafting legislation with a quill would be a very interesting policy formation approach since Congress isn't really reading a lot of the bills that they're putting out there these days. I mean, when you talk about 2,000 to 3,000 page pieces of legislation that are presented, there's no way looking at every line.
And I feel like in the study of government, there used to be more time spent on the notion of special interests and interest groups. You know, the reality is a lot of legislation is drafted by interest groups, and a lot of legislation is drafted by young folks on staff. So I remember my first friend in college who went to work down in D.C., and I asked him how it was going, and he said, Alex, our nation is run by 23-year-olds.
What was the average age of the founding fathers? You know, maybe 23 isn't that bad. So you mentioned your work in personal finance, and we talked a little bit about the difference in how Congress might approach budgeting versus how individuals and families might approach it. What are some of the other key differences in personal finance and the considerations there from your view compared to what the federal government considers in its own process?
The first thing that comes to mind is a similarity, and that's that both are getting away with it. So the idea that we needed an extra digit on that debt clock in New York didn't seem to make a difference. You know, $10 trillion was unthinkable, then 20 was, and on to 21.6 in 22, and then some. All the numbers, you know, are unconscionable. And it seems like keeping up with the Joneses in terms of our personal household economies seems like a lot of folks are traveling an awful lot and making all sorts of choices. And, you know, with social media, a lot of people, you know, make decisions about what they can and can't do because they figure, hey, these folks are getting away with it. Well, you know, sometimes in my professional life, I'm a little bit privy to, you know, some of the risks that they're taking. And, you know, some folks are not taking care of number one. And, you know, they're kind of setting themselves up to be dependent on other family or the government in their latter life for want of saving.
So the federal government has over $20 trillion in total debt and runs annual budget deficits. We're reaching $1 trillion this coming fiscal year. We're expected to sustain those numbers for years to come. Without obviously giving away anything about your clients, a hot topic in society right now is student debt or personal debt or carrying mortgage debt or having an auto loan. Do a lot of your clients come in with a lot of personal debt, or are the people who are able to sort of take that affirmative step of having a financial planner, are they in a better, you know, debt to income ratio?
Yeah, there's all kinds of debt. There's good debt and bad debt. There's secured and unsecured debt. Some of our wealthiest clients have mortgages, with the idea being, you know, why tie up that much money in your home, you know, without promising returns, kind of hope we can beat 3 or 4%, you know, or better over the mid to long term for sure. So all different kinds of debt, you know, towards different goals. We tend to not nickel and dime people as much. We're not really interested in itemizing their coffee purchases or their groceries or what have you. If you take a top-down approach and start talking with people and, hey, can you live within 99% of your income, 97.5% of your income? Almost is like you're almost being difficult or ridiculous if you say no to that, right? So living within your means and kind of seeing that, you know, that savings can be purposed towards some real things. Some people are used to having a certain percentage withheld towards 401ks, and that happens fairly automatically, right? So when they get a raise, when they're making more money, they're having more withheld. You know, we can't do that automatically when it comes to IRAs or non-retirement accounts. So it's all about having the conversations and getting the buy-in. And we personally prefer at Seacoast having the more kind of top-down approach as opposed to feeling like we are overly scrutinizing people's purchases.
So I'm going to pull this back to federal policy as well, and even elected members of Congress. In Congress, you see a lot of pushback on policy proposals and whether we can constrain certain areas of spending or raise revenue in other areas. I'm assuming, and correct me if I'm wrong, you don't get that much pushback from people who want to be your client or existing clients on making changes like that. So if you say, hey, look, you really, I know you mentioned the top-down approach, but say there's a big top-down issue and you suggest maybe constrain here on spending. What's that conversation like? Like, how do you get buy-in from a client to make that kind of adjustment?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes they appreciate the perspective of, the fact that they do spend, you know, relatively more on some areas than other folks. Everyone thinks that they spend a lot on groceries. Everyone. And they really don't. You know what I mean? Relative to one another. And if it's plus or minus a few hundred bucks or a couple thousand bucks a year, you know, that's really not going to make or break it. Most of the conversations we have to have with people really are seven-figure conversations. Mm. And the middle-class millionaire is a real thing nationally, certainly in our region. You know, if you're talking with a middle-class person who makes $50,000 a year and, you know, 20 years of term insurance at that kind of earning level without a raise, guess what? That's $1 million right there. So you start saying the million word all the time with people, and you kind of get them used to that, and they start understanding that their nest egg, their protection strategy and everything, it's not about a few bucks. It's about a few hundred thousand. It's about a few million or more bucks, even for middle-class people, to take care of the things that they care about most.
There's a lot of talk about Social Security income in retirement and whether it's enough this day and age for retirement. And oftentimes it isn't. You hear a lot about, I think the percentage is like 60% of individuals on Social Security have some other kind of supplemental retirement income just so they can make ends meet. When you're looking at advising a client, and everyone has different needs and different expectations and different lifestyles in terms of what they want retirement to look like, but what do you sort of see as the bare minimum, you know, monthly income threshold to say survive? Say you're that average $50,000 to $70,000 a year income earner throughout most of their life. You know, what do you think that person or that family might need in retirement?
Yeah. The amazing thing is the first few years of retirement look shockingly like the last few years in the workforce before retirement for most people. They spend a little bit differently, but they spend relatively the same. So that makes income and cash flow projections kind of easy. And then in the Social Security context, it just comes down to longevity. You know, Social Security started as old age insurance. Wouldn't you know it? It's not too bad if folks live into their 60s or, God forbid, their 70s or 80s. We are rooting for longevity for our clients. We love the idea of people having perhaps as many years in retirement as they had in the workforce, or at least as many years with a sense of financial freedom as they ever had as working stiffs. That's a wonderful, wonderful thing that we just need to work with.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to attorney, financial advisor, and professor Alex Talcott, as well as his son, Hank. And Hank has a little message for our listeners.
Hello, I'm 4 years old, and this is Facing the Future.
And let's continue with Facing the Future. Thanks so much, Hank. We've been talking to Alex about personal finance and federal finance, some of the differences there. And we talked briefly about the fact that we're in the New Hampshire primary, the 2020 election cycle. I want to get your thoughts as someone who works in personal finance and also is involved politically and involved with organizations like the Concord Coalition. What do you view as some of the most key or critical substantive policy issues that candidates should be talking about in this cycle?
Wow, that's a great question. I am ecstatic to look at, not for. So I will take policy in any way, shape, or form that it comes. I am not looking for an entitlement reform package from anybody, a deficit or debt reduction strategy, save Social Security. I mean, anyone willing to talk numbers or a plan or specifics, I will be all ears.
So you have a really low threshold.
I do. I'm easy to impress. and I remember in the last cycle, I remember seeing Chris Christie give an entitlement reform address at St. Anselm College, and his next event right after that was a stop at a bar a friend of mine owns. And, you know, no questions about his previous remarks on entitlement reform at the bar. It was all looking for, you know, folksy shots of him, you know, patting plaid-shirted Granite Staters on the back sort of a thing. So yeah.
I think I was at both of those events, or maybe Tyler was there with me as well, because we did this whole first budget initiative during the 2016 cycle and went to dozens of events for all different candidates. And the entitlement reform presentation was sleepy at best, if you want to describe the audience's engagement. And like you said, it was almost completely ignored even at the very next event. So I'm a little different than you in the sense that I would like to see some more constructive policy plans out there, but I also have a really, really low threshold on just talk policy. Like, give me some substance.
For the viability of the New Hampshire primary, I think it's important for the candidates to get off the stump when they're off their stump. So, like, if they're on, like a stump at a fair talking to, you know, a mass audience, that's fine. But if they're at a college or a graduate school or in a certain environment, I'm always interested to seeing the candidates who are willing to go there, who are willing to nerd out and wonk out if they have those chops. And some are more willing to do it than others. Some are brighter than others.
So let's switch gears here and talk a little bit about your teaching experience. You're teaching at UNH, also Great Bay. What courses are you teaching there?
Yeah, undergraduate and graduate finance and business law classes.
You had the Concord Coalition in for your UNH course to do a budget exercise.
Yeah.
That's something we've talked about quite a bit on the show. It's one of the tools that Concord has to engage voters, engage citizens. And as we go to 2020, we're very focused on the upcoming generations, current college students, young professionals, those that are going to start having their voice be heard in a much more profound way and become more involved. So my question for you is, what kind of response did you get from your students after Concord came in and did a budget exercise with them?
Yeah, I think the students shared some of my initial cynicism about your activity, asking, was this rigged? Because what we found is each group within our class, you know, we split up a class of 50 into about maybe six different groups or so, and each group was able to cut the federal debt to varying extents. And it was kind of like, wait, we can all do this? And it was just kind of an amazing, like, lowercase d democracy, lowercase a adulting enterprise for the students. And so it was kind of, you know, a liberating experience to see that it can be done. And, you know, not everybody needs to run for office, but they shouldn't run from contributions that they can make.
Oh, I like that. That was a great line. Did you steal that from somewhere?
William Jefferson.
Well, no, I think that's a really good point to make. It's that not everyone has to run for president, although a lot of people are going to run for president, especially this year. But I think a key point to be made is what you just said, that we shouldn't be running away from the contributions that we can make in the system. And that might be why people are so frustrated with our system as it stands and some of the election results or policy results, is that I don't think everyone is making their voice heard in the most effective manner. And that goes to another thought I had. We are in a very divisive time, and we have the era of social media and all these new technological advancements. You can effectively, you know, live in a silo of information on, you know, what you believe and reinforce that belief without really challenging yourself or very easily dismissing those who might think differently than you. When you're teaching students, do you challenge them to look beyond their own, sphere of influence? And what kind of response do you get from them when you challenge them to do that, or if you challenge them to do that?
Yeah, we're able to, when the specifics do present themselves at any given time, real numbers or real topics, usually it's an opportunity to take a step back and learn a proper noun or learn a term of art or learn an institution that gets back to how they can affect change if they so desire. So, for example, while class is not in session currently, if I were in class and likely to come up a little bit later this month, is the idea of what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has said, kind of throwing out perhaps a 70% marginal tax rate. And you don't need to get to a normative debate about that with undergraduates. Just getting to the point that, oh my goodness, there's this thing called a marginal tax rate. That's already a win. So just getting there is already what it's all about.
That makes a lot of sense. How about you personally? When you're digesting information that's out there, when you're looking into policies that you're passionate about, what are your sources? You know, what do you look at? Is it a mixture of things? Are you sort of a one-channel guy?
No, yeah, it's interesting. Kind of got to keep up with the mass consumer finance sort of a thing. You know, you can't reject the radio. You know,
definitely don't reject the radio. We're on that right now.
No. Yeah, exactly. Some of the different strategies for radio debt cutters or CNBC or CNN Money or some of those different things, like none of them can be, you know, beneath you. It's not about, I'm not going to bring up peer-reviewed scholarship, you know, by economists with clients. They're not, you know, you got to read what other folks are reading. And so, reading far and wide, CNBC, Fox Business, it's always nice to kind of go back and forth in terms of ones that have, you know, a certain political bias or outlook or what have you. If there's one bias that most consumer finance has, it's a love of big numbers. So you'll always see a headline about a merger of companies, and it will have however many millions or billions it is, or a company that's fined this amount of money. And anytime you see a number, you have to start with the reaction of, is that number big? And to just challenge yourself to find the context, what else is this like?
Well, in context, our national fiscal policy numbers are pretty big. What, a $4 trillion budget, $1 trillion deficit, $20 trillion national debt. I've got one question left before we go, and it's for Hank. Hank, my question for you is this. Should presidential candidates care about our debt?
Yes.
All right. You heard it from Hank. From the mouths of babes, presidential candidates should care about our nation's debt. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Alex Talcott, and his son Hank discuss fiscal policy, the New Hampshire primary, as well as some differences and similarities in personal and federal finance. Thank you, Alex and Hank, for joining Facing the Future. We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. There has been a fair amount of talk by members of Congress, even a bill introduced, to weaken or remove the pay-as-you-go requirement. That would be a terrible mistake and a major hit to the concept of fiscal responsibility. So, it's time to face a fact that I discussed early last year, a reminder, if you will, that pay-as-you-go, known as PAYGO, is an important standard. Current fiscal policies are unsustainable. We've talked about that a lot on Facing the Future. And common sense would then dictate that requiring those who want to enact new tax cuts, expand programs like Social Security or Medicare, or engage in new infrastructure investments to propose spending cuts or tax increases to pay for them. That is the simple concept of PAYGO. Following this concept forces explicit trade-offs among spending, taxes, and debt, which is exactly the priority-setting exercise that the budget process should facilitate. PAYGO does not prevent Congress from passing tax cuts and entitlement spending increases. Rather, it simply requires that if Congress does such things, it must do so in a deficit-neutral way. Given the dire fiscal outlook over the next 10 years and beyond, this should not strike anyone as an unreasonable burden. In fact, I'd say it seems like a minimum reasonable requirement. PAYGO first appeared in the Budget Enforcement Act of 1990 as a way to prevent the unraveling of a major deficit reduction package enacted by Congress and President George H.W. Bush. It established a statutory requirement that any legislation to lower revenues or expand mandatory spending, like Medicare and Social Security, be offset with revenue increases or entitlement spending cuts. Violations were to be enforced through automatic cuts in non-exempt programs. The concept largely succeeded in its goals, with policymakers achieving the first budget surplus in decades by 1998. Unfortunately, all the extra cash burned a hole in the pockets of policymakers. Commitment to PAYGO and fiscal discipline began to deteriorate, and the law implementing it expired in 2002. As deficits subsequently ballooned, policymakers and the public began to be concerned about deficits once again. A new PAYGO law was passed in 2010, although in a weaker form than the original and with additional exempt programs. Some argue that PAYGO should only apply to spending increases and not tax cuts. This would be a mistake. The latest tax cut is an example of that. Fiscal discipline is a commitment that must apply to the budget as a whole to be effective. Any legislation that would increase the deficit should be part of the enforcement mechanisms. Since spending and tax decisions both affect the bottom line, there's no compelling reason to exempt either from enforcement rules. Moreover, exempting tax cuts from PAYGO would encourage an expansion of so-called, quote, tax expenditures, in which benefits are funneled to the tax code rather than by direct spending. Tax expenditures distort economic decision-making and already substantially reduce federal revenue. And finally, exempting tax cuts from PAYGO would encourage the false notion that debt is a painless alternative to taxes. In a time of expanding deficits, PAYGO is common sense. It does not, by itself, reduce the deficit, but it promotes fiscal responsibility by requiring anyone who proposes a tax cut or entitlement expansion to answer the question, can we afford it? That simple question is incredibly important for elected leaders to ask and answer, especially if we want any hope of digging the nation out of its current and growing fiscal hole. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.